I'm here. I'm ready to listen, let my mind go places I didn't realize existed. At the end of this podcast, if it takes your mind anywhere close to where it takes mine, and you feel like sharing or contributing, please go to thecognitiverampage.com and contribute, donate, keep fueling that change.
Welcome to Cognitive Rampage Podcast. Hope you're taking care of you. Hope you're living your cognitive rampage. I know I am. I got to probably come up with something to say other than that because you kind of figure that's what I'm doing anyway. But I appreciate you listening and tuning in. Just so you know, in case you don't know, the second edition of my book, The Cognitive Rampage, A Scientific Approach to Self-Discovery, Change, and Life Optimization is on Amazon. If you buy that book, you get a free Kindle too. I just couldn't charge for the Kindle as well. And also remember, if you bought the first edition, I'm still doing it to where if you bought the first edition, just email me a picture proof and I'll email you a free electronic copy of the second edition for supporting the first one. We're going to talk my wheelhouse today, something I love, something I was born in, if you will, as that's my poor Bane impression. But anyway, we're going to be talking addiction treatment today with Mark Burrows. Thanks for coming on the show, brother.
Thank you so much for having me. This is awesome, man. Big, you know, very honored to be here. So excited.
Well, for me, it's I'm more appreciative, I think, because, you know, you're coming from with what I call within the trenches. And
right.
You're literally in the trenches, and I'm actually looking forward to getting back in the trenches here in the next couple of months, actually.
Yeah, okay.
I'm looking forward to it, but you're in it, man. You're literally in is it a dual diagnosis facility? What type of facility are you at?
So it's a small private practice. We do addiction medicine. We also have a family practice attached to us. So we can do, you know, a little bit more comprehensive stuff than most places. But, you know, mainly just opioid addiction. We do a little bit of alcoholism. We use different medications. We also do counseling in groups. So it's kind of, it's an outpatient setting.
For those people listening, I love that you are not clinic-based. I say in dual diagnosis facility people, which all that really means is people dealing with addiction and some sort of mood disorder, but it's in a clinical setting. I love what you said, that it's not clinical. Outpatient, will you kind of tell kind of the layman, if you will, who's not familiar, what outpatient and inpatient is?
Yeah, so, you know, typically you would hear, you know, the word IOP, right? Intensive outpatient, you know, 3 days a week, 3 hours per day. And that's a whole another animal. That's, you know, not what we do, but we are outpatient, as in we're not an inpatient facility. You know, we're not a hospital setting. It's very laid back in here. You can kind of see my office on camera. You know, very comfortable, lots of couches and, you know, pretty homey feeling. So you don't feel like you're walking into a doctor's office. But it's not a place that you would be embarrassed to walk into. We're in a regular office park here, you know, other offices around us. So, you know, that's,
Yeah, I was just trying to reference kind of that basic, and you covered it, which is now they get to go home. We all kind of understand that. And some outpatients, they work out of a sobriety setting or a sober home, as some people, recovery home.
Right. Well, like, you know, and I'm sure you're familiar, you know, with the infamous, you know, the Florida model of like the PHP deal and the residential thing. And so that's not us at all, man. We're just a regular office. People come in here. You know, at least once every 30 days, we do some counseling, they see the doctor, they get prescribed whatever type of meds they may need. And that's it. We do offer groups on top of that, but they're not required. They're just kind of, encouraged, you know?
I prefer that type of setting rather than a clinical one. The clinical setting to me, you know, unless the medical's necessary, it creates a false environment. The environment's not really like that. And I think people coming to your type of treatment is what I like, because it's more of a choice to where they're choosing to come in that day, spend mm-hmm. the time there within a real environment and bring in from their home what they're actually living in and bring that to you all.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a different feel and it's different than what I'm used to from my personal experience, in that I remember when I first started working here, you know, I was surprised that we didn't do supervised or observed drug screens, right? So people are just doing their drug screens and really they could be doing whatever they want, maybe, as far as, you know, messing around, you know, changing the drug screen in whatever way. And somebody told me, they said, well, it's a voluntary program. You know, they're coming here on their own accord. Nobody's mandated here. So, you know, they're here on their own. If they want to screw around with drug tests and kind of waste their time, then, you know, they'll probably eventually, you know, get caught. But, but we don't really do so much of that. You know, I mean, we can, if there's red flags, of course, you know, we can do an observed drug test, but it's not a, not like most places, I think, in that sense.
Do you find lifting that restraint actually a call, you know, accounts for more, self-accountability from the people coming there? Is it, it's more a tool that they can use? And do you see it be more effective like that than as opposed to the threat of it?
Definitely, man. I think that's a big thing. And, actually, you know, Glenn Marshall and I were talking about that, about like when you treat people like that, you almost encourage that behavior, you know? And, I used to work at a facility that had a big glass wall, you know, a glass window in between the receptionist and the clients, right? In the little waiting room. And you almost, you're like, you know, promoting that behavior, you know, treating people like caged animals, you know, and like in this restrictive room, you know. And here, you know, they come up, that we're on the second floor and they come up the stairs and here we are, you know, there's no boundaries, but there's no walls or, you know, barriers between the staff and the clients. So it kind of, I think you're right. It does create some type of accountability on their end, you know.
Tell me more. What was your experience like in the, I got to assume some sort of dual diagnostic or recovery center, hospital setting of some kind. What was your experience like in that?
You mean the previous work experience or
just
personal?
Your overall.
Yeah. So, I mean, so work wise, I mean, I've been around a little bit. I haven't been doing this forever. Going on 4 years working in the addiction field. I've been sober almost 6, and I got my start working for a residential treatment center. It was kind of a branch off of a very high end inpatient treatment center. And then they had their own residential program. It was with younger guys in their 20s, you know, kind of, you know, a sober house, halfway house, if you will. Yeah. They had an IOP that they went to as well. And then a heavy 12 step, right? Heavy on the 12 step. So, and I worked there just as like a house supervisor, house manager. And so I've done that. This is the third, Suboxone office, if you will. I don't know a better name to call it. You know, we're not a methadone clinic, but, you know, so this is the third Suboxone facility that I've worked for, all small business, you know, small private practice. And, I've done a little adolescent work for a state facility. That's a whole another, you know, whole another story there, but adolescents, state run agency, and I've done a little volunteer work for a nonprofit as well. And I can talk more about that later. That was a great experience. So that's all my personal, just, you know, work history. And I've been with this office now going on 3 years. So kind of moved around a lot, got to see a lot of different experiences, you know, in that time. But personally, so, in, you know, I don't know if you want to go into this, but, you know, so I've been, you know, dealing with addiction since I was 16, 17 years old. So I went to my first, outpatient facility, an IOP, when I was 17. It was up in New Jersey. It was called, It was called High Focus. And, you know, typical IOP, did that for a couple weeks, kept relapsing, got sent off to a 28-day inpatient. And so from there on out, for the next 2 years, I went in and out of treatment a total of 13 times. And so I got to see a lot in that experience. You know, inpatients, outpatients, detoxes, halfway houses, Salvation Armies, you know, the whole nine, really kind of, you know, commercial paid insurance, inpatient facilities to the state run, you know, state funded agencies. So I got to see a lot in that, just personally, you know, personal experience. So.
And tell me more, man. What was the experience? Were positive? I mean, it seems like 13 times in 3 or 4 years. I mean, it seemed like the system wasn't really working for you exactly, or maybe better than it could. I mean, what would be your takeaway from that roller coaster of in and out and riding that one?
Yeah, you know, that's interesting. I mean, and it's hard to say, right? Like, I was speaking. I did this little training last week, and somebody asked me that same question. And, you know, it's a hard thing to answer looking back, you know, hindsight. I don't want to say it was a total waste of time. Sure. I never stayed clean for more than 30, 60 days. You know, it was abstinence-based, very 12-step heavy. I just couldn't maintain long-term sobriety. I was young, you know, I was shooting a lot of heroin and cocaine. So very reckless, just like very reckless, careless. So, you know, you get some good, like,
what was the turning? Oh, go ahead, man. I cut you off. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, you get some good drug education in those treatment centers. You know, you learn a lot about the disease and the, you know, the brain and how it works and how addiction affects the brain. And, but to, I guess like anything, it's kind of what you put into it. And at those times, even though every time I entered treatment, I mean, I wanted sobriety more than anything, you know, of course, nobody wants to be, you know, sticking needles in their arm all day, you know? So I didn't want that. And I did want to improve. I wanted to be, you know, get better. But at the same time, as soon as I got in there and it got down to doing the hard work, I would find a way to kind of get out of doing things that I wasn't comfortable doing. So like, I remember doing psychodramas. I don't know if you've ever seen a psychodrama or where there's lots of them. One was, they would do like a eulogy, like a fake eulogy at your funeral. You know, they would have a table laid out with a white sheet hanging off the side. Then they would say, "Here lies Mark. You know, he died of a heroin overdose." And
yeah,
you know, here's his mom and dad.
It's like an expressive existential or expressive therapy type tactic, being in the middle of it. Yeah.
Right. Okay. So, and there was another one where they would, you know, you would confront your addiction. So they would put a chair, there'd be a chair, and the chair was your addiction. And you were supposed to talk to this chair as if it were your addiction and say all the things you would want to say to your addiction. And people would pick that thing up and throw it against the wall and kick it, you know, and try to smash it. I mean, it was, you know, tissue boxes under every seat, you know, everybody's crying. And I just wasn't cut out for that, man. Like that did not seem appealing to me. And so every time we would go do that, it was like once a week we'd have those sessions and I would somehow get out of it. I'd sit in the back or I'd kind of duck or I wouldn't raise my hand. And, you know, it was a big facility and I was able to hide out. So,
yeah, for me, the group modality, man, as an approach to addiction treatment can be supportive, but at the same time can be detrimental because when you're working that one-on-one, you can really get in depth with somebody and you don't have that group influence swaying both ways and you have a lot of group comparison. I think when you're dealing with a trauma, you know, maybe something like a violent physical trauma, then, you know, something like a group therapy is good. But any form, really, I like if it can be supportive as long as it's not destructive, you know, or encroach on change you want to make or how deep you can go. I mean, you're a therapist, so, I mean, I know I used to get more out of a person when I sat with them during the one-on-ones than a lot of times I get in a group. I get two different people sometimes.
Right, totally. You know, and I think for me, and that was part of my problem, was I was terrified to express my emotion in front of other people. So the idea of possibly breaking down and crying like that was terrifying to me, you know? So I figured out ways to get out of it. And so, like I said, had I pushed through that or, you know, if somebody paid more attention to that and kind of recognized that I was trying to get my way out,
maybe
I could have got more out of it, you know? Yeah, I don't know.
Don't look back. What was the turning point for you? What did it for you, if you will, right? Because there's that day, I think we decide, right, where we just say, okay, well, what was that turn like for you?
You know, I was 26. So this had been going on almost 10 years. I had moved from New Jersey to South Carolina, you know, ended another bad relationship. You know, another girlfriend left me, basically left the house that we had, you know, rented this crappy little apartment. And I just, man, I was on death's door. You know, I didn't have any criminal activity hanging over my head. Like, all that stuff was in the past. I became less reckless towards the end. A little bit more functioning, if you will. You know, I mean, I couldn't really hold down a job, but I wasn't committing all the crimes that I used to. And so, I was 26. I was in withdrawals. I was dope sick. Hadn't used in several days. I was skin and bone, you know, hadn't shaved. My pupils were so dilated. Tears were just streaming out of my face. And, I went to meet my dad for dinner, and I asked him for help, you know, and I stepped out of the car and I just said, "Dad, I need help. You know, like, I can't do this anymore." And that was the first time I had really allowed myself to be vulnerable, like I said, and kind of show those emotions. And what happened after that, I think, is the key, which is we kind of made a little plan of action and like, okay, you need help. What are we going to do differently this time? Right. So, you know, I said, okay, well, I'll go back to that doctor. I'll get back on that medication, which for me was Suboxone. And I said, I'll start going back to meetings because that's all I knew, right? I mean, all I knew is there's AA and NA, you know, and then there's rehab, you know. So I just did that because I didn't know of anything else better. And then the important part was I actually did what I said I was going to do. So the next day, you know, I went to that doctor and started going to meetings. So like the action piece, you know, and I know that's common sense. That's a very like obvious thing, but for addicts, we're great at talking about what we want to do, not what we're going to do, you know? So there's a lot of talk about tomorrow, you know, but we never actually put it in today's perspective and start taking action on it. So that was a big thing. That was a big difference for me, you know? So I guess that was the turning point, you know, that was September 4th, 2011.
You remember it like that. How long had you been, trying Suboxone, if you will, for how many, what was the stretch of term before you got back to it this time?
Yeah. So I never, so, you know, I know every region is different, so it's kind of hard when talking about this stuff, but up in the early 2000s in New Jersey, you didn't see Suboxone used for long-term maintenance. It was only short-term detox, right? Like 3 to 5 days. So I was always, you know, as the years went on, I had heard about this long-term maintenance approach and I was kind of against it, to be honest with you. And I think a lot of people with addiction kind of had a bad taste in their mouth as far as Suboxone maintenance or medication assisted treatment in general, because you just thought it was a crutch or, you know, people weren't really in recovery or really sober. So I was always kind of anti MAT. This time around, I had never tried it long term. Okay. But roughly a year before I got sober this time, I had given it a shot. And so I went to a doctor, started taking it, but I wasn't serious. You know, I was, you know, taking it some days and then using it on the weekends, or maybe selling it or trading it for what I really wanted, you know? So I wasn't serious about it. So I did that, kind of, you know, beat myself down with that for about a year, before I finally came back on September 4th and got more serious about it. So.
Yeah. Well, I mean, to titrate off the medication and if someone's in dire need, I'm a fan of what works is, you know, for myself. So, if somersaults do that, if titrating on a medication properly does that and it saves you from overdose, and then by God, use that technology. But I think both you and I speak to that idea of that belief. Am I really using this, as a tool, as a real tool for this moment, you know, not to be held on to or anything like that, right? It seems how it always seems to circle back to that belief, right? Mm-hmm. That belief of why I'm doing it. I know it's because I have to. I got off the pill, right? But there's so many ways. But I'm a fan of whatever changes the belief to keep somebody alive.
Right.
Is what I'm a fan of, as long totally. As whatever, as long as whatever keeping you alive isn't just keeping you surviving, right? And not right. It really allows you to live and go beyond it and move past it. Not as a right. crutch, but as more of a ladder, a rung to move forward, to move a little right. further.
Or what about a bridge? You know, I mean, what about thinking? I was thinking about this over the weekend and. You know, what if we think about people who struggle understanding medication-assisted therapy or are not really okay with it? I get it. I understand, you know, that's a long time belief. You know, that comes from years and years of you know, abstinence-based thinking or 12-step thinking. And all that stuff works for people. I'm not knocking it. But it obviously doesn't work for most people, right? Because if it did, we wouldn't be in the situation we're in. And I think, I mean, I don't want to go on a rant, but I do think that.
Oh, by all means, sir. That's what we do here.
Go on my rampage.
Yep.
I do think that Alcoholics Anonymous's own numbers report roughly 5%. Success rate in long-term recovery. I believe that 3 to 5%, I think that's what they say, you know? So obviously, you know, it works for some people, but not the majority of people.
That's why I used to get frustrated that because that was the foundation of the approach in most of the treatment. That's what I argued about. I didn't argue that it wasn't helpful. It didn't help certain people and et cetera. My argument was the 5% self-reported recovery rate. And this is the foundation. This is all of our treatment right. here is built upon this, something I never even had a class for in my master's right. degree, yeah. mental health counseling. And, right. you know, that was my biggest, you know, rampage against that, right? You know, was that idea. And the same came with Suboxone. I had a bad taste in my mouth. Watching a majority abuse the idea and even doctors. Yeah. Tending to assist the abuse in the idea because
right.
the doctor would titrate and transfer medications to keep a client, you know, because then patients could switch doctors whenever they wanted to within hospital settings even. Mm-hmm. And certain doctors were known for cutting you the narcs, and certain doctors were known not for. Some really right. wanted to titrate your ass off. So if, right. you know, and they would switch. And I spent years, you know, dealing with a population like that. And when you do see it work, though, is when you go, okay, there's that fucking 5%. Hell yeah.
Right.
You know, and that's why I just thought we should be able to offer more, if not access to all of it easier, you know, to right. where you should almost have a fucking menu. You know what I mean? To where if you're ordering,
sure.
you'd be like, yeah, I want to try this and try that. And all this should be, it's, I don't know, maybe it's a utopia, but.
Well, yeah, maybe. I hope not. But that's really, you're right. That would be nice. God, if we had more options, you know, than just whatever we kind of fall into, you know.
Or whatever insurance allocates as treatment.
Right.
I mean, insurance determines treatment. So the guy sitting in some right. office on the 15th floor somewhere in suits that no insurance plans are going, all right, we can give 30 days, but it needs to be cognitive right. behavioral therapy mixed with. And you're like, you don't even fucking know, man.
Right.
Like, right. you know, if we could pull from psychedelics and Kratom sure. and all natural, I mean, fucking throw the book at it all, you know?
Mm-hmm. Sure, man. All these supplements and, you know, I think you, you know, talk a lot about the Onnit supplements. You know, there's tons of great stuff out there, man. And we sell a little bit of that. And I'd like to get more into that because we have medications or, you know, alternative, you know, supplements that can replace benzodiazepines, that can replace sleeping medications, you know, the mood enhancers. I mean, there's some really interesting stuff out there that's so underutilized. Like nobody's using this stuff, you know?
Yeah. Government's not passing out tests to try to deter people from using the pharmaceutical.
Right.
That,
right.
You
well,
know,
and,
I mean,
and the scarier thing about that is even the pharmaceutical medications that we have for addiction are majorly underutilized, you know, I mean, I know we always talk about Suboxone and methadone, but what about like naloxone? Like, why does every single person who walks in a treatment center not walk out with a Narcan? You know, like, why is that just not an automatic thing? I mean, we hear every day about this opioid epidemic, and every 16 minutes, somebody's dying from an overdose. Why are we not handing out Narcan left and right? You know, so everyone who comes in our office gets a Narcan, you know, one of these Ebzio, you know, little, injector things. Right. So stuff like that, Vivitrol, I mean, you know, people getting released from prison or getting released from inpatient, give them a shot of Vivitrol, you know, give them a little bridge to get to their next step in life, you know?
Yeah, I think access to everything. My point is, if we should at least have equal access to everything else that's holistic, as easy as we have access to everything else that's synthetic. Mm-hmm. I mean, at least that. And, you know, I think the people working in it should be able to come at you with a biological approach, a nutritional approach. And they do in a lot of these facilities. They try to set it up that way, but it's not functional medicine. It's 1995 medicine, you know, food pyramids and shit. Right. You know, you're not getting that true functional medicine study of what we know today, even as far as, how we know environment is beginning to have, it looks like, a little more influence than the genetic base, than just accepting what genes we have and a genetic predisposition, that actually environmental change can make that not even come out, can make predispositions go away.
Interesting. You know? Yeah. Whereas we always used to hear about the geological cure, right, and how that never works. And, you know, it's like, well, actually, maybe it does. Maybe we've been missing that for a long time.
Well, you take a kid in some environment at the right age and remove them from an environment that, say, came from a genetic pass down of, I don't know, pick the autoimmune disorder or predisposition, and you put that child and develop it in a completely separate, loving, social connected environment, mental stimulated, physical, and those predispositions, those genetic implications don't show themselves. Now, put the kid through trauma or some experience and you may see some of that. But I think with awareness of those ideas, the fact that the environment and our change mix what you and I talk about again in the beginning was the belief, right? How much you believe that, all right, I need this, or how much believe that I don't need this or I need that. And being able to be aware, because I agree that I lean away from the disease model. But I understand the implications that when you use, your brain is all kind of fucked up and you can't trust anything. For me, that's a level of awareness. So if I know that my thoughts, my feelings are not to be trusted, and that the brain can heal itself, then over time, you know, but again, that's a person's belief, the awareness, you know, what they want to put in action. I get fired up about this shit, man. Cause for me, we incarcerate people behind jails. Right. They make so much money when all of that money could pay counselors and specialists and all kinds of shit. You could specialize in, whatever helps, whatever works. But we have such limited access to so many things and such a narrow-minded view to treatment is my biggest fucking rampage about the whole thing.
Sure, sure. You know, I was talking to a client this morning about, we have something here in South Carolina called ADSAP. I don't know if that's a countrywide thing or not. I'm guessing it's not. And it's basically where you go. It's the classes you take for drunk driving or for a DUI. Yeah. So they make you go to ADSAP classes, which is it's court mandated. It's twice a week for roughly 8 weeks. It's $60 a class, $20 for every drug test. $80 for the application fee. And that's not even counting the reinstatement to get your license, and then SR-22, which is like that's what we call the special auto insurance you have to have once you get a DUI, right? So you're talking thousands and thousands of dollars. And I was talking to this kid and I said, man, it's so interesting, because I'm sure, you know, none of that form of punishment is preventing you from drinking and driving, you know?
Right.
So it's like, we put all these fines and all this, you know, the form of punishment on the person. Excuse, I guess, would be, well, that's their penalty. That's to prevent people from drinking and driving. When in fact, I'm sure it has no effect at all on somebody drinking and driving, right? Like, nobody who's about to drink and drive thinks, well, I don't want to get SR-22. or I don't want to pay all these, you know what I'm saying?
Right.
And if I'm wrong, you know, if punishment works, then, you know, correct me, but,
on a very small scale. And that used to bother me too, is I'd see people going through the recovery system, which many times can have you financially crippled. And right. You do get popped with some, driving with a suspended license or something you forgot to fix or some shit. You get hit with a $300 fine that you can't really afford anyway. You end up doing 30 days in jail and can't post your $2,000 bond, where somebody that has the money can just pay this stuff, get out. It doesn't matter. And you watch people get caught in the legal system while also entwined in the addiction system. And I was like, why the fuck is this connected? Now, if you're going to jail or you've done those things, you can have the treatment, you know, work on those things. But it seemed like it was a revolving door. I would have them in my office, in the group room and therapy room. And, you know, 30 days, they're coming to pick them up out of there because of some warrant they forgot on a taillight ticket or some shit.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, the classes, this kid that I'm talking about, you know, he said the classes are actually pretty good. Like, they're educational, they're informative, there's some good groups, they do some good workshops and stuff. And that's awesome. I'm not saying let's not do that, but let's not penalize the people, you know, let's not punish them. I mean, imagine if we got out of that way of thinking, the punishment way of thinking, and tried to treat instead, how beneficial that could be to people. And really educate people. And I love, Dr. Carl Hart, who I know you've had on here, which is amazing.
Awesome guy, man. Love that guy.
Yeah. Yeah, dude. I mean, yeah. So, and he's a big advocate for, like, let's have honest education, like awareness, like let's just inform people of why they shouldn't drink and drive or why they shouldn't, use, you know, heroin and a benzo at the same time, or, you know, whatever the case may be. And I love that approach, man, because I feel like it would have such a greater impact than, you know, finding the crap out of people.
I believe it so much. That's how I raised my daughter. I raised my daughter that way. I didn't outstead of these bad, evil things you can't fuck with or alcohol anywhere. I literally was like, here, hold this. Look, this is what weed looks like. This is what it does to you. Here's what we don't know. Here's what the studies do show. Here's what they don't show. Here, I didn't hand her anything else. But other than that, you're going, here's the education.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I'm not saying that you're going to hit cocaine and immediately die, okay? But I'm telling you run a risk of a heart failure. You run a risk of a panic attack and stroke. But it's just, hey, it's what's there. And I think when they have that knowledge, you kind of make that decision a little less emotional, maybe.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, well, and at least you got that trust factor. I mean, at least you're being honest with them, because one of my biggest grievances or resentments is DARE class in high school. Did you have DARE, drug awareness, whatever?
Yeah, dude, we just designed the back of the new Tribe of Change t-shirts on the back where it says, just say no. We did no in like the old DARE red paint script.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, nice. I like that. I'll have to get one of those.
I'll send you one. I don't sell them or anything, man. I just send them out to tribe members and stuff.
Okay. All right. Hell yeah. I just remember that. And it was like this fear mongering, you know, the just say no, the this is your brain. This is your brain on drugs. And what a crappy way of doing things, because that's what it was, right? Like, if you do cocaine once, you'll die. You know, if you smoke marijuana once, you'll kill all your brain cells, you know? And just complete dishonesty. And when what happens, like to me, I'm sure with others, you know, you get a little older, you do start to experiment a little bit, and you find out that none of that stuff was true. Like, it was all just lies. And it's like, holy crap, I've been lied to my whole entire life, my whole childhood, about why I shouldn't do drugs, you know. And there are real reasons, but teach me, you know, give me the honest approach, you know.
You tell a kid he can't have that. Tell a kid that, you know, she can't ride that. And what's the kid do? He's like, oh, my God. And that first time they uncover it when their friend, you know, lights one up or whatever, and they go, well, he didn't die. He didn't explode like I thought was going to happen. Then you open up that curiosity. I think you kill the curiosity, I think, with competence, with exposure of competence. Not saying definitely don't be the parent that says, hey, come smoke with me. Come drink at our house. At least I know you're doing it safely. You're fucking stupid ass if you do that.
Right.
The idea is educating, right, of showing this is why it's used. And right. I think responsible use, too, in the parents' realm is, you know, don't be saying you can't do this and then every other night you're wasted, you know, walking around with your wine or some shit like they don't observe you.
Right, right. I think, and like you said, man, that person who is taught all those things and then sees that marijuana doesn't make you retarded after, you know, using it, or you don't die off one line of cocaine or whatever the case, you know, when you see that, then you have complete disregard for everything else you've learned, because now all of a sudden you realize this person's, you know, I've been lied to my whole childhood, you know, so why am I going to believe anything else these people said if I already found out this isn't true? So I think that's big, man.
Go ahead, man. I had a question for you.
No, I was just going to say, I just think getting back to the ADSAP thing, the DUI stuff, I just feel like, you know, if we had more emphasis on treatment and less on punishment, of course, right? Like talking about decriminalization and legalization and all that other stuff. I mean, it all kind of goes hand in hand. So,
yeah, what's your view on the idea that you see it come out a lot, is that all, and I emphasize the word all or every, that all addiction is based in trauma or pain?
I don't know if I can subscribe to like all. It's hard for me to say all or nothing, but I definitely see a big you know, relation from to trauma and addiction. You know, I know, I think Dr. Gabor Mate, right, doesn't he speaks on, you know, childhood trauma, early childhood trauma is related to all addiction. And that seems a little like extreme to me, but I definitely think he's onto something, you know, and there's definitely a relation there. For sure.
Yeah, I find it most of the people, at least in the clinics or even the community counseling I was doing, are dealing with some sort of trauma. I mean, it's a lifetime. I think what he's pointing out really, though, is kind of obvious, is the idea that we all experience trauma at one point.
Right.
And on some level, some subjective level that affects us. Some people experience trauma and they use that as growth for some, and some use it to fester, you know, as a cancer. So the subjective idea saying it's all based in trauma or pain, it's hard for me, like you said, to grasp onto it, but it is truly effective. But what came first, right? The addiction, the trauma, the pain. I think
we'd all
be addicts on that level. Maybe we are. Maybe at some level we all are addicts and have our own addiction somewhere.
Just hasn't come out yet. Yeah.
Yeah, or it manifests in other things like, you know, work or physical health, even, you know, certain stretches. Yeah. But I don't know. I think, go ahead.
Well, I think, no, I'm right there with you, man. And I think, you know, the hard part is, you know, defining trauma, you know, what defines trauma. And so when we think trauma, we always think, you know, these big earth shattering events, but maybe that's not the case, right? Maybe it can be something smaller that we wouldn't necessarily perceive as trauma, but it's having, you know, it's all about how we perceive that event, you know. So you and I could go through the same exact event. To me, it could be traumatic. To you, maybe not so much, right? Or maybe it's traumatic to both of us, but I handle it in a different way that, you know, goes towards addiction or whatever. You know, we're talking addiction, but it could be anything, right? So, I talk about that in my life. You know, I had a sister killed in a car accident when I was 9 years old. And so that was my trauma, right? So, well, around the same time, I had a childhood friend who lost his mother to cancer. And we were both roughly 8, 9 years old. And I remember always thinking about that family versus our family. And so I obviously went into, you know, acting out in school and doing bad and starting drugs, you know, smoking cigarettes and drinking, you know, kind of your natural progression through childhood with drug use. But that other family, you know, like the kid was like valedictorian, you know, like number one in the class, you know, star athlete, you know, went on, you know, they all went to good colleges right out of high school. So it's funny to compare both those traumatic events and see, you know, us go one direction and that family go another direction.
Wow.
You know, so I think it's all, you know, I guess all about how you handle it, you know, after that.
Yeah. Sometimes I reference the ghettos in the mind frame, that no one else's tragedy is worse than another's because that's your ghetto. You know, whatever happened to you, that's how you deem it. And, you know, right. that we can change that perception of what happened to us, that we can at any moment really is being, if we're willing to question that, right, of what really happened yeah. to us, can we shape a better narrative or a better picture? But I'm also not that naive to think just simply reframing your way to sobriety is necessarily right. the end all to be all. That's really what I wrote my book about, man, is I saw so many people in the practice where you were either a behavioral person, you're a cognitive person or a cognitive behavioral person, or right. you were a synthetic person, right? You or a naturalist and or an environmental believer. And what I wanted to do is I kind of incorporated, pull all that shit together and said, wait, they're all kind of right on some level. And but it's all really linked to your belief on that influence as well. Some right. not like biology, but it's kind of like all of it, right? It's you got to take the full on approach. I don't think it's an individualized approach at all.
No, man, that's huge, dude. I mean, I think that's like the biggest thing that we all need to learn about treating addiction is that it's not a black and white disease. If you want to call it a disease, gotta be careful with my words. And and it's not a black and white treatment either, you know. Right. So what works for you might not work for another person. And you know, MAT, medication assisted therapy, is the same way, you know, MAT doesn't work for every single person exactly the same way. And nor does, you know, a lot of people have a problem with that because they think, oh, well, it's medicine, it's science. You're talking about doctors. It should be a science. It should be, you know, ABC, you know, to your cure, you know, or, you know, 2 + 2 equals you're cured, you know, or whatever. Right. And that's not the case. And so a lot of people have a problem with that because that they want it to be like that.
Well, I think that's their misconception, man, is that they believe that science is this one and they don't understand it's fucking theoretical, that the medical right. approach for the most part, probably opposite some mechanical shit we're learning or no, but the medical part, the chemical part, the interior, this, it's for the most part theoretical on a lot. You have a lot of this to happen. A lot of this could happen.
Right.
It's in mental health is the same way, that the diagnoses are theoretical. We have some research right. that shows this and this, and we subscribe as a majority to this theory. Mm-hmm. And I think people do see science as being, well, it's factual, when really I right. think science is the idea of continuing to question what we think is factual.
Sure. That's a great way to put it, man. I just love it, you know, that I realized actually recently, you know, I'm always having these kind of battles in my head about this stuff. And it occurred to me that, you know what, abstinence-based treatment or 12-step treatment is not a science either. You know, there's no one, you know, you can't tell someone, okay, you're going to get sober in AA. Okay, well, how many meetings do I need to go to? I don't know. How many per day? How many per week? I don't know. How long should I go to them?
One day at a time. One day at a time, Mark.
Right. Yeah, I'm going to start saying that with MAT. Well, how long should someone be on Suboxone? One day at a time, man. I don't know.
They do the most doctors, man.
Yeah. You know, I mean, it's like, you know, when should I start working the steps? You know, how early should I start working the steps? You know, when should I start sponsoring? I mean, so we don't know any of this stuff. So to pretend that it should be any different with MAT, you know, I think is a little, you know, wishful sure. thinking or ignorant, you know.
Yeah, I can see that, right? The guy tells the story. I know the grandma or the grandfather, right, looks back and tells you the story. In 45 years, quit cold turkey. Never had another drink after.
Right.
Some shit happens. He's like, I don't know. It was Tuesday. I went fishing. I woke up, and I never had another drink. And then that's it. There was no science behind it. There was no acceptance, right? No, no idea of powerlessness. He just changed his fucking mind. And that's okay. So maybe there is a science we've yet to discover about that belief, as we refer to it, right? That subconscious mm-hmm. or conscious belief. Maybe what we're really talking about when we say belief is this unknown, explored, conscious or subconscious idea that we don't even know yet, right? So we just kind of call right. it like, that's what you believe, you know, whatever you believe.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, and shit, you know, AA, you know, has been going on, what, 87 years or something, close to 90 years now, I think.
What, 1939, I think, some shit like that.
Yeah. So, you know, they've been at it a long time and they still haven't figured it out. You know, MAT and a lot of other addiction treatments, you know, are pretty new in the grand scheme of things. So, you know, we're still figuring this thing out. And kind of like what you were touching on in the beginning about a lot of these, you know, somewhat sketchy doctors in the field, you know, that has done some damage to the perception of MAT.
For sure.
And I get it, you know, I completely get it. And in this area, there are quite a few Suboxone doctors, if you will. And I'm sure every single office is doing it a different way. You know, they all do it differently. So we're all kind of trying to figure this out and kind of weed out the bad apples.
Well, what I'm saying is there should be a Suboxone approach to treatment available. There should be a marijuana treatment approach available. There should be, right. You know what I mean? There should be a shops of all of you everywhere for anyone right. to approach without the idea of going, I am a diseased addict, rather than the fact you're being affected by addiction, right? Right. If I'm having a bad lower back, I go because I'm being affected by my lower back. I'm not a bad lower back. And right. if we can lift that stigma of that, hey, it can happen, right? It can, and you know, for me, the trauma also, I meant to mention that it's all trauma. Well, sometimes right. what I was seeing is like 7 out of 10 people in the group, they were just somebody that had a shoulder surgery and weren't really educated. Next thing you know, it was, you know, they're going through a divorce, their life's falling apart. They don't know
exactly.
Why.
Yes,
and for
yes.
me, I'm like, well, where's the trauma there? They just had surgery is a fucking trauma for real. That's a biological trauma. So right. maybe it could connect there. But for me, I saw a lot of that. The uneducated person that just goes, oh, thanks for those pills, you know, and off right. to the races.
Man, what I see so much of, and I wish I knew more, you know, like about the brain science and stuff, but, I see a lot of, you know, we get a lot of chronic pain patients that had some type of injury or surgery, procedure, no history of drug use ever, right? Good job, family, whatever. You know, start taking painkillers. And then, like you said, a couple months later, they're hooked. And so I look at that and I say, like, what is the connection here? How is this happening? You know, where is the trauma? And a lot of times, what happens is somebody has a surgery, they're put on pain medicine, and at the same time, you know, a loved one passes away, they go through a divorce, they lose their job, or maybe like you said, a biological trauma, you know, they can't be as active as they once were, they can't play sports anymore, whatever the case may be. And yeah. boom, there you go. Like that's the connection. Something changes with the neurotransmitters, something changes in the brain chemistry, and now all of a sudden you have physical dependency.
Well, it chases that endorphin response, that feel good response that you get right. from those pain meds. So you head that way. I mean, life happens, right? And if timing happens when you happen to be sure. on that last week of the opiate treatment for your arthritis or some shit, and next thing you know, oh my God, this happened. You take things you can't trust your emotions. So you're all caught up in the chemical imbalance of it. Yeah. Then your responses to those life happenings. Begins to build this traumatic narrative. And next thing you know, you're 5 years into a narrative you've been telling in 7 different rehabs saying that same shit, you know, without right. that clarity moment to really find that baseline and let your brain get back to that, reassess right. and know that shit, life does happen and timing, you know, can affect a lot of what we choose.
Yeah. And I think, right. Like if I think what you're saying is, you know, that person is in, I don't want to say denial, but it's like a form of denial because they think they're saying, hey man, I took this as prescribed. I've never done drugs in my life. You know, I didn't go seeking this. Like I had an accident and I was given these by a doctor. You know, it's not my fault. I'm not an addict, you know, blah, blah, blah. But they're missing or they're just not picking up on the fact that like, well, hey, well, tell me about that divorce that happened right after that accident, or tell me about, you know, losing your father, you know, right after that right. surgery, you know, and it's really fun on my part, you know, in my job to kind of to find those little missing pieces to the puzzle and help that person who thinks, you know, it's not their fault. They took it as prescribed. You know, they didn't do anything wrong. At first, that's a very difficult person to deal with, you know, because they're a little, better than.
They're using that projection. It's not my fault. We want to be right. So I'm here. It's not mine. And then when you tell that person they have a brain disease, they see, I told you it wasn't my fault. I have a disease.
Right. Which is interesting, right? About the whole brain disease, you know, people in the rooms, man, AA, they love that crap. Like that's a brain disease, you know, it's a brain disease. You know, that's,
Yeah. Well, what we're saying is your brain is a little tweaked the fuck up right now. We're not sure what it's doing or thinking, so you shouldn't trust any of it, including identifying yourself as an addict or having a brain disease. Wait till you get a little clean, let the brain heal up, right? Let's go through some changes. But I mean, all of it really, it can have an effect on, and people can use it two different ways too, because you can treat a disease sometimes too and beat it. You can beat cancer as a disease. So there's other things, but what Leo always taught me is I never said that I am headache. So I when I say I'm depressed or I am an addict, these are identifying words that have strength. So, I mean, just saying I'm being affected by addiction, one loosens it up. You're not your headache. You're not your lower back. You know, you're not your job, you know, you're definitely not an addict the way I see. Now for some people, it's also how you perceive what an addict is, right? If an addict is something positive, negative, you know, it has different approaches. Right. So whatever I think that personal definition is.
Yeah, I get it. Like I get, you know, identifying as an addict, but you're totally right, man. I mean, if we really do want to treat this as a disease, you know, no other disease is doing that type of stuff, you know? So, you know, I guess I got my start kind of in a nonprofit here in Greenville called Favor, Faces and Voices of Recovery. And I got to give a shout out to them, man, because they're huge and they're doing big things and, you know, no fee for service. And they're just doing big stuff for awareness and advocacy on the disease of addiction or topic of addiction. So their big thing is the language of recovery, right? Like the vocabulary that we use, you know, and getting like you said, you know, you would never say I am headache, you know, my name's Mark and I'm headache, you know, my name's Mark and I'm cancer or diabetes, you know? So, that's a big thing for them, man, is, you know, to erase the stigma and the shame that's associated with addiction is working on that stuff. And it's, it can be a nuisance, you know, certain words that are just so easy for us to say I'm clean and sober, you know, well, let's not, you know, you would never, you know, be cured from cancer and say you're clean. You know, you would just say you're cured or you're in recovery or you're recovered or whatever, you know? So we say clean because we associate addiction with dirty, right? Like being an addict is dirty. So we say I'm clean. Yeah. So stuff like that, I think, and I think they're onto something about changing. Well,
I'm not clean, man. I got my caffeine going, right? I mean, the idea is, to even take that, I like the approach of saying, look, Don, you're not clean. It's not an idea being dirty. If, look, we've been doing this shit since we were kids. We just call it something else. When we were 3 or 4 or 5, you watch a child stand in the middle of the room and spin around or have uncle somebody throw me up in the air, throw me across the pool. And they come back, they do it again. All that is, it's mood modulation. It's we modulate our mood to see what happens and to experience all of that. So for me, it's modulating our mood with caffeine, right? We modulate our mood with sex. We modulate our mood with sleep, with food, with stimulation, physical. I mean, so it's how do you want to modulate your mood to think that the abstinence idea of going, all right, I am not going to modulate my mood whatsoever with any related chemical that may actually feel good for a minute. Right. And then to withstand this, it's you're asking a kid not to play in the kitchen with all the utensils. You know what I mean? Right. It's you got to just, I think when we look at what it is, and I think, you know, if it could be as easy as going, I went to my doctor, this happened. Obviously, I think they need pre-counseling. I think before that surgery happens, that person should have not 3 days, not insurance determined, but a good couple months or whatever, good education on, listen, you're going to experience this shit with these pills. This is what happens. This is what your body feels fucking good. It feels fucking good. Right. And when life happens, you may experience something to feel a little bit more traumatic than it really would be. Then you'd be taking it at your base biological level.
Right.
pre-counsel those people into the surgery. Then when they're coming out, offer the free counseling along the way. You know,
sure.
They'll do outpatient surgery with them just to be like, all right, you sure? We're going to titrate you off these opiates. You know, they kill you anyway if you're at the house and just can quit right. with alcohol. But, you know, it's just more fucking open the doors. But I think the day – I'm going the fuck off, dude. I think the day that insurance takes the walls off of setting whatever the treatment is, when we lift those walls, when the FDA even lifts it to other things that are just as equally powerful or less deadly as others, when we can lift all that and we also have the feeling that, oh, man, I just woke up. I realized I'm going to get more pills and didn't even want to do that. You know what? Here's a treatment facility that I learned about that does it this way that I liked. I like this mm-hmm. belief. I'm going to try this treatment, and then I'm going to try this treatment. And, that's fucking shit, man.
Yeah, I know. Hey, we deal with every day, man, you know, trying to get medications approved on people's insurance plans. And you've got somebody, you know, in a different country who can't even pronounce the medication, trying to dictate what my client is going to be taking, you know, and I have to go through his hoops, you know, and play his game to get something freaking paid for by the insurance company. You know, it's every day, man. And the person doesn't even know, you know, can't even pronounce the medication, you know, has no idea. They're just looking at a form, you know, and checking the boxes, right? And that's like who's dictating this person's treatment, you know? It's crazy, man.
I would agree, man. The more education. You know, the one thing I also do is I talk a lot of shit about it, but I try to offer solutions on the back end. So not only just opening up the doors to all the treatments, all types of practitioners could practice. There should be a private practice for anybody that says this helps doing something with somebody if it helps. You know, at least that way, you know, maybe a little less synthetic in my bias, biased way. But also I think, I know Glenn, we talk about him, guys, look up the Addictive podcast, by the way. Mark was on with Glenn. Yeah. Glenn's been on my show a few times. I've been on Glenn's show, but check him out. My brother out in Hawaii, but, he's doing what I think, should be the next level or the next where we start to really put the money is not in the clinics, not in the 30 days, 60 days where they're banking all kind of money, wasting all kind of money, but in home, sending the counselors to the house, sending the counselors into the environment that the person is experiencing.
Is that what he does?
Yeah.
He does like in-home counseling?
Yeah, they're in the community. They work together with going to places and people's homes. What I think should be the next approach is, you know, you know, it's the idea. Most people I'm generalizing, but a lot of people would come to rehab, do the 30 days, and then I'd have to plan their next trip, which was going to be a complete move to a different place. Right. As if moving to a new place is only going to prolong. You'll find your fix here anytime soon. You just keep running from it rather than going into the environment, not removing them for 30 days, which is artificial, but then trying to help them, teach them, here's how you make new friends. Here's how you go to new places. You know, take them to a fucking theater once, right? Have experienced new things, new groups, do something different. I think that's what I think is the next wave.
That's huge, man. I love that idea. And again, you know, not to, you know, stick on favor, but that's what, you know, that's kind of what they do. They do a lot of recovery coaching, volunteer recovery coaching. And, you know, that's pretty much, I mean, they're, you know, they would be able to do that type of stuff, you know, bringing that person out into the community and doing, you know, engaging, you know, outside of the home or in the home, you know, wherever, but in that community. And I think who is it that says, I just so believe it, you know, the opposite of addiction is not sobriety. The opposite of addiction is connection, you know. And
Gabor leans a lot to the social connection theory as well, is the idea that it's pain, trauma, and a lack of social connection.
That might be him. Okay. So, and that's huge, man. I can totally, you know, get into that. I think, you know, connection, you know, that's why 12-step groups work. You know, the steps are great. That's a new way of living. There's a lot going on there. But that's why they work. It's a fellowship. It's a brotherhood. You're meeting friends. You're meeting other people who are not partaking in drug use or alcohol, you know.
By far, dude, that is the biggest pro on that side list, man, is that for sure. Yeah, no doubt. I'd credit 3-4% of that 5% to that right there.
Oh, if not all of it, right? I mean, I just, yeah, Totally, man. That's why it works. That's why a lot of these sober homes, the place I used to work for, that residential center, you know, it's all young guys that come from a similar background, same age group. And a lot of, you know, and it's kind of like a fraternal, fellowship, you know, and they live in the house together, they cook, they clean, they eat, they sleep together, in the same bedrooms. I mean,
I was going to say, well, you've been the most inpatient.
Yeah. Right. A little rehab romance. So, and often times, a lot of them end up staying in the community. You know, they might not be from this area, but once they finish their stay, they end up, you know, getting an apartment down the street, you know, cause they want to stay where their roots are, stay where their meetings are and their groups and their friends, you know, and it's connection, you know, it's huge. I mean,
and at the same time, it's also its downfall, because when you hang out with the same people at the same places, talking about the same things, you're leaving your environment really susceptible to a quick exit back.
Yeah, I'm sure. I mean, I think, you know,
it's like doing group therapy for sex addiction. You put right. 7-10 sex addicts in a room together. What the fuck you think's going to happen eventually?
Right.
You know what I mean? It's the idea of, I'm not sure that modality is the best, but that's with anything, right? Greatest strength, greatest weakness. Generally our best thing is also our hardest thing, especially for most theories, man.
Dude, you're deep, man. I love it, bro. I love it. You're on a different level, man.
No, I have my moments, man.
Tell me about Joe Rogan, man. How was that? That was the first. That's how I found you. I don't know, what was that? 2 years ago or something?
Yeah, that was back in 2015. I have some podcast regret I have from that show for sure that I will live with for eternity. I was half the time, man. When I got out, I'm like, what the fuck did I just say? I was just I've never really done a hard podcast like that. I was doing my bullshit Ustream things and not doing much. And
So you weren't doing Cognitive Rampage at that point?
Hell no, man. The name of my book at the time was Mastering Life Transitions.
Okay.
And I was doing a Ustream thing, talking shit about addiction, you know, that kind of thing.
Right.
And I made a couple generalizations on that show that it made me sound pretty much stupid. So one, when he goes, so do you think it's a disease? And I said, nope. I didn't leave. Like, I sounded like a closed-minded, narrow fuck, right? I wasn't open for debate or, you know, idea why I can see it, et cetera. I said no. And then I regret, because I said that the patients are treated like Ritz-Carlton VIP.
Okay.
And I didn't put the context out properly, and it made it sound like I had no love for the person. As I was saying, like, well, I become their travel planner. Like, I'm booking their treatment over here. I'm finding their doctor. I'm finding where they're living, you know. But what I really meant was you'll appreciate this from both sides. What I should have said and tried to poorly connected was, what I meant was, when sometimes I'm working with a patient and the patient wants to do this or wants to do that, and I don't think it's good for their treatment plan that we have into effect, they want to change doctors because the other doctor they know will give this out. They're kind of making their own treatment plan. And then I would kind of go to my director and say, hey, look, he's complaining because he wants to do this, but I think it's important that he sticks with what he's doing. Their doctor agrees even. And then they would go, well, I'm going to leave. I'm going to walk out. And then the money director would say, no, you have days left. It's okay. We'll just transfer you, whatever you need, whatever room you need, whatever doctor you need. Just stay here. Let us keep using your days that are bought and paid for. Mm-hmm. Please don't leave. And then they would get what they want. And so from a practitioner standpoint is what I meant, is they're treated like Ritz-Carlton VIP, because they know if they want whatever they want and they got days. Now, no one would act like that if they didn't have days. Knowing they had a couple, they wanted an extension, can I have 2 more weeks? Nobody acted like that. But when they knew they had a good, solid inpatient 30 days, shit, it was give me what we want, and I couldn't treat. It would tie my hands as a practitioner, and that's what I meant.
What kind of facility was that?
That was dual diagnosis facility.
Okay. That was in Florida.
Yeah, that was in Florida, man. I was, it was definitely on the train, but I said that. And then the one thing, man, it echoes in my fucking head. Yeah. See, you see, can you see the pain that still goes over top of me? Not too close.
Well, because you probably still hear about it, right? Like, do people still email you and shit? And...
Oh, fuck yeah, dude. I get cursed out on a regular, man. And, well, there's two other things, man. One, I said Suboxone is just like heroin.
Right.
And that's not what the fuck I meant, man. What I meant was is you ended up needing that as much as you needed the heroin anyway. So I would see you go, all right, I got to have here. Then it was still a belief that I needed something else other than the tools that I can provide in my own life to change it. And instead I said, nope, it's just like heroin. I know it doesn't get you fucking high. That's not the point. For me, that was common sense. So it was more or less like same thing. Yeah, it's the same thing. Right. Same thing. So one, I made Joe look stupid because he was like, oh shit, same thing. And I'm like, generalized just because I'd drawn a line in the sand and came out poorly. And then the one that echoes in eternity for me.
Okay.
He goes, so the cognitive rampage, that's cool, man. What's that mean? And I said, well, when I talk, I get kind of rampagey. That's how I fucking define my whole brand, man. Like, my belief, what I fucking was fighting in the system, all of this shit, I summed up to I get fucking rampagey. I was like, you, what the? Come on, man. You know?
Man. And who else was in the room? I don't remember. But he was interviewing someone else, and then they brought you in, right?
Yeah,
I just remember that.
Dude, Nick DiPaolo is a beast.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
I fucking love that comedian, bro. He's a fucking killer, man. Like, he's a comic and a half, man.
So is you, Joe, Nick DiPaolo, and was Red Band there? Red Band was
across from me, and the guy you see in the background, the long hair, was the one of the senior staff writers for the Rolling Stone, who was interviewing Joe Rogan.
Okay.
It was kind of trippy.
So you were a little bit nervous, to say the least. Yeah.
Fucking hell, man! I thought I was walking into a podcast not started. I did not know one was live.
Okay.
I had no fucking clue, man. And so as I stepped in the thing, I was like, oh, fuck, we're live?
Yeah.
Shit, dude. You know what I mean? And I sat down. You can hear my voice. I'm nervous as shit in the beginning, like, ha, ha. I was like, man.
That's so funny, man. But what an experience, man. I mean, what is, you know, the number one podcast, like, in the world or something, you know? I mean.
It was a trippy thing, man. It was when I was working addiction, I was a fan, I think in 2011 or so, 12, something like that. And, my buddy Sean Zernis put him on to me and I started listening. I was like, and at the same time, I'm going through the addiction treatments. I'm getting the masters. I'm finishing. So I'm experiencing this type of treatment as I'm listening to his podcast, which is questioning a lot of things.
Right.
And I'm freaking out. So I used to say it all the time. I said, I will be on that fucking podcast. I used to say that shit like crazy, man.
Oh, then it happened. Oh my God.
24 hours after eating some mushrooms, I was on his show.
Oh, is that what happened? Okay. So, so you ran into him at a club, or you ran into a friend of his at a club or something? Okay.
Yeah, just ran in. I didn't run into him. The pre-story was fucking awesome, man. I was out in the desert, the Joshua Tree, and I was having a wonderful visual, spiritual moment, let's just say it was a beautiful psychedelic spiritual experience in the desert.
Sure.
And kind of remember thinking coming out of that this line that said, when you're on the mic, say it loud. When you're around your friends, chill the fuck out. And I was like, well, I don't, Mike, I had stopped doing the show. I wasn't doing anything. And fucking 24 hours later, dude, he was at a show randomly at the Improv. He wasn't scheduled to be there. I figured, fuck it. I went to go say hello. And he had a group around him, and it got all awkward. I was fucking stoned. Yeah. And I'm like, from like 15 feet away, I'm like, never mind. Fuck it. And I walked away, and he's like, nah, man, hang out. It was cool as shit, man. Dom Marrero was with him, a couple other people.
Nice.
Just so fucking nice, man. And I wish I'd been more prepared so I wouldn't have generalized like that and said a lot of things that initially aren't true, you know, should have elaborated that it's really the overdoses that come from using Suboxone and the heroin from shooting when you have Suboxone in you. And why risk that? If you know you have a better chance of death doing Suboxone and heroin, well, fuck, you know, it was more that.
Well, yeah. And I'm sure just like everybody, man, including myself, I mean, the world is like kind of shifting where there's the shift right now that you're seeing towards Suboxone, you know? I mean, a couple of years ago, man, I hated Suboxone and I thought all these kind of misperceptions about it, you know? So, you know, I think, man, you know, you're covering your tracks now by being honest about it and speaking out about it. And, you know, you'll continue to get pestered with emails, I'm sure.
Well, for me, it was the only form. Again, it was the only form of treatment. It was take 12 steps, swallow right. NA or AA, and then swallow this pill. Together, I was going, all of this is the only thing as a foundation that we're offering. Sure, we had Tuesday CBT training, and sure, there was mandated right. insurance, cognitive practitioner therapy written up in the policy of what's performed in group. It sounds good, you know what I mean? But when I looked at it, I'm like, we're offering pills, 12 steps, NA, and that's it. And for me, it ends up knocking what's offered when there's nothing else offered. You know what I mean?
Sure. Yeah, sure. No. Well, like you said, you know, it's like this limited menu. You know, we have – there's tons of things that can help addiction, and yet we only subscribe to, you know, 2% of them or something, you know. So, you know, I get it, man. I get it. You know, it's a changing time, man. And that's – it's a really, really exciting time to be working in this field because there's so much going on with this opioid epidemic and – in the media every day, it's on the news, you know, big government pushes and, you know, I go to these conferences and you get to hear about what they're talking about and what's going on with medication assisted treatment. And, it's an exciting time to be doing it, man, for sure. I mean, how often, you know, how many people get to work in an occupation that's like on the front page of the news every day, you know?
It's a growing treatment. I mean, it did get bad media-wise because it became difficult, I know, for a lot of clients or patients I was working with to find a doctor. I was trying to book their halfway house and find a doctor that would give them Suboxone. That was one of the hardest discharges. If I had to do a Suboxone discharge, really? That was one of the most difficult because it was hard to find a doctor that would do it.
Yeah. And again, you know, it's different in every region of the country, right? I mean, we have here in Greenville, South Carolina, there's probably a dozen different small offices, doctor's office settings, you know, and some of them are bigger with lots of comprehensive thing, you know, stuff, and some are just a doctor, you know. You know, we provide other stuff as well. But so there's a lot, you know, it's easy to get.
Patient history played a lot into that too. So the patient history, the chart that's being transferred, that played a lot into it. So whatever the patient's history was played a lot, whether the doctor would accept him. It got to the point where you'd almost apply. You'd send your client, your patient toward them, and then they would reply back through insurance plus through them of going, okay, we will accept this person. So a lot of it was based on patient history.
Right, right. Like does their resume hold up or something? Yeah. Yeah, I know. I have a buddy who owns a treatment center residential program in, I think, near Scottsdale, Arizona. And his opinion, at least, he's told me that there's like no Suboxone out there. He said there's just no Suboxone in that area, you know. So, again, you know, it's state by state, region by region, and
which I think if it's a science, then it should be applied as such. Then it would be an argument to me is it why is the treatment approach so different state to state to what's offered, what's not offered? Right. If it's a science and if what's being offered is repeatable, then it should be duplicated in every state.
Right, right. Well, you know,
or offer it fucking all it fucking all, you know, that's kind of my argument is, all right. Oh, it's not. Okay. Well then offer all of it then.
Yeah. You know what I mean? Right. Right. You know, we've got a long way to go, man, I think, but these conversations are great. And like I said, there's this shift happening right now. And you know, what happened was, I'm not an expert in it and a lot of people are, but you know, to my understanding, you know, you had 12 step thing, you know, meetings happen in the 30s. And then, you know, a lot of most of the people who worked in the addiction field came from a 12 step background themselves, you know? And so we've created these beliefs and we've kind of just been restricted. We've restricted ourselves to just 12 step, you know? And I think now, because the problem is as bad as it is, you know, we're being forced to look outside the box, and which is a great thing. You know,
that's kind of why I'm like kind of looking where you're at. You're not held within the 12 steps there. What other approaches do you apply where you're at?
Man, we do whatever you want. So, you know, I have some guys that I play, you know, we play music, man. He comes in for counseling. We play acoustic guitars together, you know,
music therapy, baby. I love it.
You know, if somebody wants to go, you know, my background, you know, I got sober in AA. So in AA and Suboxone. So, I'm open-minded to it. I just don't think it's for everybody, but same thing like Suboxone. I'm open-minded to it, but I don't think it's for everybody, you know? But if somebody wants to go to AA, I'll encourage that. Favor has, they have their own meetings. They're just kind of open addiction meetings. I'll encourage that. Nature, man, if religion, you know, whatever is important to that person, spirituality, you know, exercise, health, man, I think health and fitness are huge in the addiction field. Or in the recovery area, because it's something that people lack so much of in their addiction. You know, we stop taking care of our bodies, or maybe we never even knew how to do it in the first place. You know, it's a very cultural, you know, / generational thing, you know, like this learned behavior of diet and fitness and just drinking enough water. Man, I have conversations daily with my clients. They probably hate it, about like, how much water did you drink today? You know, because I have people that literally drink sweet tea and soda all day, every day, you know, never a full glass of water, you know?
Yeah.
And, in Greenville, man, we have like some really good, like top 10 cleanest tap water or something. So there's no excuse, you know? You know, so stuff like that, man, drinking water, eating fruits and vegetables, buying local, fan. You know,
substitute treatment. I'm a fan of trade health and health and wellness for the addiction. Trade it. Who gives? Yeah. You know, somebody would say, "Oh, you just trade in one addiction for another." I'm like, "Well, fucking do that, because this one won't kill you at least immediately."
Yeah. Right? Yeah, man. When I was first in recovery, on a Friday night, I would eat like an entire thing of Ben and Jerry's ice cream, watching a movie, and because I had nothing else, I had no social life. You know, I wasn't going out, and was single, and I had this old timer tell me, he goes, "Well, I've never heard of anyone overdosing on ice cream," you know? And it's like, that's what we got to do, man. Like, find things that work. You know, I was talking to somebody yesterday about, their cocaine use. Okay. This guy was just sharing to me about he's struggling. He's trying to cut down. He's trying to moderate, which is interesting, right? Cause nobody talks about moderation. Right. And he was trying to figure out ways how to moderate. And he had a daily amount, and he had like a budget set for how much he would spend on his daily cocaine use. And it was very small. It was like he would use a little bit after a meal, after dinner or something. And so I said, "All right, man, well, let's like write out the things that cocaine does for you. You know, what do you like about it? It gives me a little euphoria." He said he liked the tingling sensation in his nose. It helped clear his sinuses. So he wrote down these things, and I said, "Okay, what are some ways we can replace that? You know, what's another way we can get some euphoria? You know, maybe we can start doing some exercise, you know, get a little runner's high. Maybe there's another type of nasal spray, you know, a nasal spray that also clears your sinuses and gives you a little tingling sensation. I don't know, you know, but just try coming up with these ideas, you know.
Wim Hof, deep breathing. You can get yourself a little, whoo, you're breathing it just right, you know. I mean, I love it, man.
Oh, yeah.
That's the approach. Yeah. I love what you're doing. Yeah, take it.
Yeah, man. So I just think again, it's individualized. And
what's Dr. Carl Hart say, right? Where he talks about, what is it, 15% of people that are using methamphetamine or whatever drug it is, we identify with the people on intervention. When the truth is, it's a much larger percentage that are using day to day, that are like the person that has the glass of wine every other day or something like that. They can moderate. And I think I had Dr. Andrew Hill on this podcast. He was on Joe's show too. And they were working at a place where they were doing that, where they were literally teaching moderation on how to use the drug safely, et cetera, be that alcohol or anything else. as opposed to abstinence, as opposed to whatever, was finding right. And what a cool behavioral approach is, as if, you know, but you can hear NA and AA, right? Oh, you're just accepting.
Oh,
right?
My God. Dude, if you talk about moderation anywhere, I mean, you might as well get prepared to, you know, find a new job, you know, because
well, even though that's 85% of us that are operating, working, using drugs and alcohol in moderation. So we operate on moderation, and we can't teach moderation.
Right, exactly. That Sinclair method that's going on, I don't know a ton about it, but, you know, teaching how to drink with moderation, you know, huge, man. I'm all about it, dude. But I mean, yeah. Oh, talk about something, an unpopular idea. You know, it's, you know, we still subscribe to this belief that it's all or nothing, you know, one drug and we're hooked, you know, that idea. And also cross addicted, you know, I mean, I don't think everybody, if you have a problem with heroin, I'm not, you know, I'm not saying that you would have a problem with marijuana or with alcohol, you know, right. I don't, you know what I'm saying? Like, right. However you want to call that.
Yeah, I'm with you. It's why I did a few drugs in my history and I wasn't like, okay, all right, that's my shit. It was other things that would become, you know, it's not this or that, right? I agree. To call yourself an addict means, well, oh, I have an addictive personality. I can be addicted to anything, right?
Right. This idea that if you're sober, you know, if you have a painkiller problem or an alcohol problem, you got to be abstinent from all drugs, you know, all mood and mind altering drugs, is just not true for everybody. You know, maybe some people, yes, maybe that is true for some people. But, you know, me personally, I don't, I stopped drinking, not because I was an alcoholic, but because I had hepatitis C, and hepatitis C is a liver disease, and alcohol is the number one, offender for your liver, you know? So, plus financially, I was,
for me, alcohol was always the bridge to the Coke. I have a,
there
have
you
a
go.
Drink, and then I'm like, ah, fuck it.
And that's the second reason, right? Alcohol brings me back to cocaine. Cocaine brings me back to, an opiate. So, you know, these personal reasons, but, you know, who knows, maybe someday I'll just, you know, I've since been cured of the hepatitis C and went through the, Harvoni treatment. It was great.
Fuck yeah, man.
It's awesome. And, who knows, maybe someday I'll have a glass of wine with dinner. I don't know. I mean, I'm not doing it today, but I'm open to the idea. I don't smoke marijuana because I have other focuses in life right now. You know, I have a lot to go in my education and career, and I don't know. It's just not something I'm into right now. But I'm a huge – I love pot, though. I think it's great, you know, and maybe someday that will happen, you know. So, I mean, you know, so I'm just saying I think, you know, kind of opening up to the idea, because some people are really turned off when they're told that because you had a problem with this, you can never do any of this ever again for the rest of your life, you know? And,
but remember, you're human and you have personal defects and recovery is part of life. So pretty much we're setting you up to know that can't do any of this ever. Don't touch. You know, you got to touch and you're going to do that for the rest of your life because it's a part of it.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. I know, man. I just, another new person I started working with, avoided treatment. He avoided his Suboxone treatment because he was told that he could never drink again. Like, you know, because he was in Suboxone treatment, he could never have a taste of alcohol. And this guy doesn't even like to drink, but occasionally he will. And he literally avoided treatment because he was forced into that restrictive environment, you know. And again, kind of circling back to how we opened up with, you know, treating people like, you know, this caged animal, you know, you're just, you know, you're not making it easier for people. And it's not very appealing to most people, you know? So I don't know, man.
I love sharing the passion. I love seeing people though, that are in the trenches like yourself, man, that are doing it from a place of experience on both sides of the therapist chair. that I know you got into this because you wanted to get really rich one day.
Right. And totally. Yep. It's all about the money.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, and the fact that there are people like you in the trenches that are doing it, my love goes out to them and yourself, man. And I appreciate you coming on and sharing your life, your experience, what you're in, and all your perceptions with me, man. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, man. And, you know, one thing I'm excited for is and actually Glenn kind of turned me on to this. You know, that drug policy reform conference coming up this year, I'm excited for that because I think that is a lot of like-minded individuals that are talking about things that you and I are talking about right now. I think that's going to be
what's the date? You know the date and all that? Shout them out,
man. The Reform Conference. I believe it's in October. It's in Atlanta this year, which is great for me. It's 2 hours away, but that's the big national reform, you know, drug policy reform conference. You know, Google it. You know, Reform Conference 2017. It's in October, I believe, in Atlanta.
Yeah.
Something Glenn's been interested in, you know, he's been involved in, and it's just, you know, you find this new wave of addiction counselor or addiction, you know, helping professional, that's, I think, getting away from those old school ideas of abstinence 12 step only, you know? So I think you'd find your family there, man. I'm excited. I can't wait to go. So
yeah, I may see if I can get a little more involved with that. As long as those, like you said, conversations are happening, then progression can be happening. And we can't just keep saying this is it and this works for everybody or else.
Right. I want to see the menu, man. I want to see Adam Lowry's addiction menu, addiction recovery menu. You know, I'll have the number one, please, with an extra large, you know.
With an extra coffee and.
With an extra large music session or, you know, music therapy, you know, whatever.
And pet therapy. I think you got to get my puppies with me. I think I'm a huge believer in pet therapy, too, man. I mean, you mix all that shit in, dude.
I had my dog at the office yesterday, man. People love him, you know, sitting here on the couch and just, yep.
Some of the best treatment I ever saw for dementia and Alzheimer's patients, man. I used to work in a dementia unit. And let me tell you, it was difficult for a while trying to counsel the family and do things. But every time I'd bring the dog in, man, let me tell you, the whole room would light up. People came alive, man. It was awesome. Beautiful thing.
Awesome, brother. Well, cool. Well, thank you so much. I got to get back to work.
Keep saving lives, man. Keep saving lives, stay in the trenches, man. I love what you do. I know a lot of people don't say it, so you know, I appreciate what you do, man. And keep staying in the trenches, helping people, and doing what you do. Thank you.
Thank you so much, man. Appreciate it. It's been a pleasure.
See you, Mark.
Later, man.
So how was it? Did you like it? Did you love it? Let us know. Go to thecognitiverampage.com. Feel free to contribute, donate, keep fueling the change. Whatever it is that you guys can do to help continue to allow this to happen. None of this would happen without you and your love and your support. And of course, your contributions. Love you.